Welcome to the Representing Rural Podcast. I'm Candace Williams, and today our guest is Mara Teakin. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Candace. Good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us today. So Mara has worked with RCA for a decade or so.
Yeah, even longer.
around rural school consolidation research. So she's researched research on how rural school closure affects the communities. She started this work out in her book is called Why Rural Schools Matter. And in that book, I remember especially the community of delight was highlighted, and she spent a lot of time with Dorothy Singleton, who was a former employee and a founder of Rural Community Alliance. They went all across the state to communities that had been affected or were on the brink of being affected by what we know in rural Arkansas is Act 60. And that's the mandate, the law that mandates the schools to either consolidate or annex after two consecutive years of 350. So Rural Community Alliance was started back in 2003 after that law came to be. And initially that law stated that schools were less than 1,500. And that's how RCA was started, because that would have totally wiped out most of rural school districts as we know them today, that 1,500 number. So that initial advocacy by Rural Community Alliance brought down that number to the 350 as it stands today. But in 2015, we were finally able to get enough support from legislators to get a law passed that allows school districts, when they get to that 350 number for two consecutive years and threaten to be closed or annexed, that they can apply for a waiver to remain open. As long as they're fiscally, facilities, and academically sound, they can remain open. And just recently, well, last week, four districts were granted that waiver. So that was the whole basis of RCA being founded, is to save our rural districts, which we know means so much to our rural community. So we were especially proud to see these things come to fruition. And no school has been closed because of Act 60 since 2015. So we're glad to have Mara on. She'll give a little background about Act 60 and school closures and rural Arkansas and the public education landscape as a whole. So you ready, Mara?
I'm ready. Yeah, it's okay. Good to be here. And, I'm really grateful for RCA's work, especially to win that waiver. There's still a number of paths to district consolidation, which then can lead to school closure. But being able to apply for that waiver has been a lifesaver for a lot of rural districts.
It has. And it's warming to see, districts actually being saved. But now we know, yes, they're still open, but we have to make sure that we continue to advocate so these districts can thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are ways that districts still can be consolidated. As you mentioned, being in academic facilities or fiscal distress means that you get put on kind of a list in the eyes of the state, and you risk coming in and getting consolidated by the state. Mm-hmm. They can force consolidation if you are in one of those three kinds of distress for too long. So the threat is still there, and it can it's real, because what happens is when districts get consolidated, they often become their community members become a minority voice on a school board.
Right.
And so then when the new school board looks to save money, they often decide that closing schools is a way to do that. And so district consolidation then can mean school closure. And one thing I should just point out is, this idea of saving money is one of the big rationales.
Yeah.
For district consolidation, mm-hmm. but there's really not any good research to show that district consolidation actually does save money.
Definitely.
So one of the biggest arguments you often hear lawmakers making is, it'll save all kinds of cash, but really we don't think that's necessarily true. So there's a lot of kind of I know, I think political rhetoric and like mythology around consolidation, but there's not good research to support the, that it actually achieves the goals that people think it's going to achieve. And actually what I'm finding in my research is that it can really carry some big negative effects for communities.
You're absolutely right. So we know how important schools are to small rural communities. It's been stated probably more than once that they're the heart of the community, and they are. I'm from Elaine, and our school was closed. I was part of the last graduating class in 2006, and there's nothing like losing your school and driving past those buildings that were once, you know, you walked those halls before, and to see those buildings just sit there that could be utilized, it's hard. So do you feel that rural communities are doing enough to remain relevant after consolidation?
That's a good question. And I think the first thing I'll say is just that it is hard. Consolidation can really feel like quite a blow, both for students, but also for the community. And it can bring, you know, a feeling of like helplessness and powerlessness. But I think it's really important for rural communities to not give up at that point. So the first thing I would say is that, you know, district consolidation and school closure are two separate things. They're often linked, but they are separate. So if your district has been consolidated, if you can fight to keep your schools open, like if you think that your school is strong and is, you know, really serving adults and children well, I would try to keep them open because these schools are so important to communities. But if the schools do end up getting closed, as you mentioned, you know, it can be really, it can be devastating to have that empty building in your community. And so I would recommend finding a use for the building. And rural schools, you know, when they're open, they're really important, like social and cultural centers for communities. And so if you can, they can continue to play that role. I think that's really important. So I've seen, you know, in Elaine, for example, the school still continues to serve as a kind of community center. And so that's great. And it's still then a place for people to be able to gather and stuff. And in other communities, I've seen schools being used as youth centers, or sometimes if a community can keep a preschool open at their school site, or also being able to partner with local universities. You know, many universities now are, you know, establishing kind of rural satellites or rural hubs in various places. And so this might be a great place to be able to establish, you know, invite a university in, establish some sort of rural outpost. And then, you know, people can come take classes or, you know, do all kinds of things. So I think finding a use for the building is really, really important. And with that, I would definitely advocate keeping community control of the building. You know, if the community, if the building gets sold to a particular person or to a particular individual or to an, even to an organization that doesn't represent the full community, the community has kind of lost control of that building and all kinds of things can happen. And so that's a real risk. So try to keep it, try to keep that, you know, building within the community power there. And this has really got to be, you know, in the control of an organization that has the entire community's best interest at heart. And I believe in Elaine, it's an alumni organization. Is that right? That now controls the building?
The high school building,
Yeah, exactly. And so now, you know, it really can serve as a place where alumni and everybody in the community feels welcome and can use it. And so that kind of control, I think, is really important. But then even just, you know, apart from like how the building gets used, I think it's really important for rural communities to try to maintain good economic health. You know, closing a school can bring an economic hit to a community. And so, you know, you really need to be able to turn out to support businesses that, you know, hire locally and that are innovative and they're planning for the future. And I think also, you know, for rural communities, I think maintaining good demographic health is really important. Rural communities, they need to grow and change. And right now, most of the growth in rural places is actually growth among the rural Latino population. And so, you know, I think being able to kind of to adapt and welcome new families in and welcome new communities in is really important, you know, for both maintaining a population base, but also just, you know, I mean, being an open, welcoming, inclusive, warm place. I mean, that's the kind of community that we all want to live in.
Right.
And then I, you know, also I think addressing inequality is really important. Our entire, you know, country right now is experiencing a racial reckoning. Mm-hmm. And this is not just happening in cities. Rural communities are also facing this. And many rural communities are sliced with really big racial divides.
Yeah.
And these divides can make communities inherently unstable because people aren't communicating and they're not cooperating and they're not living and working together. So we need to address that fundamental inequality. And then just the final thing I'll say too is, you know, it also sounds kind of like you're asking a question about like the relevance of rural communities more generally. Mm-hmm. And I just, I'll point out that 20% of the U.S. population lives in rural communities. And so we are relevant, just based on the numbers. You can't erase us. So we really need to come together and demand that, you know, we have policies that actually meet rural needs right now.
Thank you. Some rural districts, they spend a lot of money on transportation. They spend a lot of money on transportation budgets just because of the nature and the landscape of rural Arkansas. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of travel on a lot of gravel roads. and as we know, the adequacy study is done every 2 years in between legislative sessions to study and put a better figure on how education can be adequately funded, per se, by the state. And there has been some talk about possibly changing it or having two adequacy pieces, one for schools, I think they said over 500, and one for schools with less than 500. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you know, that's equity. Mm-hmm. That's equity. That's what we're trying to get to. And I'm not sure if it'll come through with this adequacy study that they're doing and hired a firm to do it and everything. I'm not sure if it'll come through, but I hope it does. And I hope in some part implementation will begin, you know, for the next school year.
I'll just add there. Like, I think this distinction between adequacy and equity is really important.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because, I mean, first thing, just the language of adequate, I think is kind of telling.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that enough. Kind of implies like a bare, exactly, just enough. Yeah. And, you know, I hope that we would try to be funding our schools more than just mm-hmm. enough. But then, you know, even if we're just thinking about adequacy, we're not thinking about, are we actually making sure that all districts have what they need?
Yes.
And that's equity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we might think that in general, we've got enough money going towards education, but we're not actually looking at, well, you know, how are districts with less than 500 versus more than 500, you know, faring, or how are districts in one part of the state versus another part of the state faring, or how are students that are, you know, schools that are predominantly serving white students versus black students, how are they faring? So those are questions of equity that, you know, I think we really need to be wrestling with. Adequacy is great, but that is only like a small, you know, a small part of things.
Yes, only a small portion. So once a small district faces issues such as fiscal and academic, what advice or guidance do you have to pull themselves up, or any help you feel like you may offer or advice?
Yeah. So yeah, you're asking about like a fiscal or academic distress.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, first, I think if you can get those issues resolved, do it. Being in distress, at least in the state's eyes, and I think that's an important distinction, mm-hmm. just because the state has a particular rubric for how they evaluate distress, mm-hmm. And that might be very different than how the community thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
But being in distress, at least, you know, in the state's estimation, makes you vulnerable to consolidation. So you need to try to address it if you can. And, you know, I think it's really important that the community has a superintendent they feel like they can trust,
mm-hmm.
And who puts students and the community first, and both students and the community
yes.
first. you also really need to make sure you've got a school board that you trust, because the school board's the one that's going to hire that superintendent. Mm-hmm. So this is where you've really got to make sure to, you know, get out the vote, and, you know, be careful about who you're electing. So, you know, once you hopefully have a superintendent in place that you really trust, that leader really needs to be communicating with teachers, especially around academic distress. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure you got a high quality curriculum. You've got to make sure that teachers feel supported, that they understand the issues, they understand how to address them. I also think it's really important to make sure that kids don't get scapegoated, especially around issues of academic distress. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they hear this kind of rhetoric of like blaming the students yes. for test scores. Yes. But, you know, test scores are an indication, they're an output, right? Mm-hmm. They're an outcome. And they are an indication that we're not putting in enough resources then if we're not pleased with where the test scores are. So we need to be addressing the input side and thinking about what kind of resources are we actually putting into education? Okay. What kind of curriculum are we using? Who are our teachers? Rather than just blaming the kids for where the test scores are. And then if it's fiscal distress, I mean, the best advice I can offer is, you know, hire a really diligent and ethical bookkeeper. Yes. You know, oftentimes I think that districts, you know, fiscal issues don't tend to pop up overnight. Mm-hmm. There's something that, you know, come from decades of, you know, mismanagement or even just kind of like lax management. And so really hiring somebody that, you know, that, you know, can get you back in the black, I think is really key. And then throughout all of this, like really establishing open lines of communication with the community, you know, because if it comes to, you know, a point where consolidation is a threat, you're going to really need the community out to rally around the schools. Mm-hmm. And if the community feels like they can't trust the district, they're not going to do it. So I think really open lines of communication, transparency is super important. And then the final thing I'll just say too is, being proactive. You know, I can't tell you how often I have worked with schools or with districts that have said like, oh, we just thought it wasn't going to happen to us. We just couldn't imagine that we'd ever get to a place where we would be closed. Yep. Yeah. And as you know, well, like when you get to the point of like, you're having that conversation, it's already too late. And so you've got to stay on top of these issues of distress. And then also be really proactive in how you are addressing them, how you're communicating with people. Because I mean, you know, again, you know, this, like the state will come in and consolidate. And you know, there gets to be to a point where it's too late. So I think being really proactive and like the kind of work that RCA does with really organizing communities, if you've got a strong community, you've got a chance right. of, you know, staying open.
I agree that transparency piece is so important. As hard as sometimes the truth may be, mm-hmm. Administrators, it's so important for you all to be as transparent as possible to your community. And it'll be good if it's before, you know, total yeah. collapse and it's too late, you know, for the community to kind of be all hands on deck. And you also hit on a very good point, pretty much about the whole child. So, you know, of course, you know, every school would, you know, have high scores and everything with roses and gold. If
yep.
Statistics, if the test scores only relied upon what that child did or what they experienced while at school, you can't, but that's not reality. You have to account for that whole child and equity. Again, what does this child need yeah. to succeed? What does this child need to be their very best? So, and I think COVID has really just laid all that bare. Mm-hmm. The importance of equity and not just putting a blanket cover over, you yep. know, issues and what, you know, administrators or community members single-handedly may think is the end all be all, but finding out exactly what this child needs. So I work from home. My child is doing virtual learning now, but I don't have good internet connection at home. So Caleb's equity is not the same as one of his other classmates that may live in a better area, you know, that has good internet. But they may not have a parent that works from home and it has the flexibility of doing virtual learning.
Right.
So it's really just finding out, you know, how to best help our children so they can succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you're bringing up a point about like the difference between equality versus equity. Mm-hmm. And so equality is giving everybody the same thing, where equity is giving everybody what they mm-hmm. need. And so, you know, right now we're seeing a lot of districts, you know, they're saying things like, well, everyone's got access to the same curriculum. and, you know, yes, the same curriculum exists for all students, but not everyone has equitable mm-hmm. access. You know, you need a better internet connection at home. And, you know, another family would be great if, you know, there was a parent who could stay home and work from home and be able to help support their kid. And so our needs are vastly mm-hmm. different. And so we really need to be tackling this question of, well, what is it that families and students actually need? And then that's when we're getting into issues of equity.
Yeah. I hope we're getting closer to that, you know, to that. I feel like we are. So do you foresee any changes or new opportunities for rural public education or public education as a whole?
Yeah. Great question. So I'll start with, I've got to say, there's a number of things that keep me up at night yeah. right now. And so I'm going to start with the concerns, but then I'll move to some of like the areas of promise, I think. So some areas of concern, like first is financially, economically, like things don't look good. We know that municipalities are going to be struggling. Mm-hmm. Budgets are going to be tight. It's going to be hard to raise revenue. And this could last for a while. And this could mean layoffs. It also could mean a risk of more school closures.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as we talked about, school closures are often made with the idea of saving mm-hmm. money. And so if people are feeling financially pressured, they might, you know, we might be shutting down schools. So that's a huge concern. Also, in many areas, the pandemic has caused a move to private schools or to homeschooling mm-hmm. Because parents feel like these options offer more certainty and control in a really uncontrollable, uncertain, changing situation. Mm-hmm. But what this does is this could lower enrollments, which decreases public schools' revenue, which could also bring closures.
Yeah.
And then another big area that I'm concerned about is what we've just been talking about, inequality. Specifically, like right now, there's growing income inequality. And we see this reflected in our schools with, you know, big widening gaps between our wealthiest and our poorest districts mm-hmm. and our wealthiest and our poorest students. And schools, unfortunately, have to operate in this reality. I hope policymakers are going to address those underlying issues of equity, inequality, and like, you know, specifically like these gaps between, you know, wealthy and poor right now. But schools are going to be forced to be dealing and working in that reality, and they need to serve all students well. So that's a big area of concern. Remote learning, I think, is both a blessing and a curse, or a threat. The good side of this is that I think as students and administrators are growing more comfortable with and more adept at remote learning and remote teaching, it could give rural schools increased flexibility to offer all sorts of, you know, really rich, engaging curricular opportunities or offer programs like dual enrollment where students are taking college level classes. So that could all be really good. My concern is virtual charter schools.
Yeah.
Our federal administration right now is really big on charter schools and virtual charter
yep.
schools. And I worry about them being seen as a viable alternative to brick and mortar, you know, regular mm-hmm. schools. But we know that the outcomes for virtual charter schools on the whole are quite weak. And so they're not actually a viable alternative. And besides, there's all kinds of benefits for having a brick and mortar school anyhow. What I'm worried about is that this moment is going to bring these kind of virtual charter schools even more to the fore than they have been. So those are my concerns. The opportunities, I think, one is changing demographics. So on the whole, rural America is growing and is growing more racially and ethnically diverse. And both of these things are good. This means more people, new ideas, new innovations, new opportunities, a rural population that more closely reflects the rest of the country. So that, I think, is a big area of promise for rural communities. Another one is more opportunities to support post-secondary education. More and more rural students and rural adults are pursuing higher ed. And this training can really pay off in terms of, you know, greater job flexibility, increased salaries, that kind of thing. And so rural schools, many of them are doing some really cool things to be able to support students, like dual enrollment, or, you know, offering all kinds of you know, credentialing, that kind of thing, to be able to support their students. So I think that's really good. And then community schools. And this is something that rural areas often already do really well. But this is where you specifically locate various services and programs at the school, because it is so central to the community. So you might, you know, offer, you know, medical services or adult education classes or English classes at the school at night for students and for adults. And it really capitalizes on rural schools being the center of their communities. So I think that's a big area of promise too. And then the final area, I think, is just that I'm hoping right now that one big silver lining of the pandemic is this increased recognition of the importance of schools. And so, you know, there are some pressures that could lead to closure, but I think there's just a really renewed understanding of how just how important schools are, and especially rural schools. And I'm hoping that in the future we're less likely to take them for granted, both for their educational benefits but also for their community benefits. So that's my like fingers crossed silver lining. You know, I hope that we continue to value and value even more schools right now.
Whew, that's all I can say, because my appreciation for teachers, specifically my son's teachers.
Yep.
Oh my goodness, I just want to go hug them all and just thank them and buy them lunch and dinner and everything else, because I get it. I mean, I think I get it, but it's just so much. And like you said, teachers are appreciated much more now, because we get a picture or a snapshot of what their job is. So I know I appreciate them, and I'll just be happy when we can get back to some sense of normalcy. For myself and my son, but
exactly, and I just hope that sort of renewed appreciation for teachers doesn't go away. You know, and you know, and it's teachers, but it's also just the building, and it's, you know, staff, and it's being able to, you know, schools are providing hot lunches and breakfasts and all kinds of services that you know, we too often take for granted. And so, you know, again, I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that this renewed appreciation will stick for a little while.
I agree. Well, Myra, do you want to add anything else?
No, I just really appreciated the time talking to you. And I'm going to say too, I've just always appreciated RCA's work. You know, y'all do such important work, you know, building and empowering communities, and also helping them support their schools, and also, you know, holding school and education policymakers accountable. And so thank you for that work. And, you know, we need organizations like RCA more than ever right now.
Thank you so much, Myra. And again, you guys, if you want to check out Myra's book, it's called Why Rural Schools Matter. You can find it on Amazon. It's a great read, of course, and you'll get to read about some of her journey as she researched and talked and walked with people residing in rural Arkansas. Thank you, Myra. It's now time for the RCA Rural Arkansas Power Moves. And the RCA Rural Arkansas Power Moves are simply things that you all can do as rural residents of this state that are for the betterment of rural Arkansas.
and for your local community. And you could probably guess the first rural Arkansas power move that I have this week, and it's the 2020 census. We're countdown. It's 5 days left. Thank you all for completing the census. Thank you all for encouraging your family and your friends to complete the census. If just in case, you know, there's someone left that you know or can think of that may have not, just, you know, tell them, hey, we really do need to get this census completed. I think today, September the 25th, Arkansas has a 98.9 enumeration rate. So that means that 98.9% of the percent of the households have been accounted for. So we're getting there, and I'm pretty sure we'll get closer to that 100 come September the 30th. So the second rural Arkansas power move would be registering to vote. Again, October the 5th is the deadline. If you have not registered before and you plan on participating in the November 3rd election, you have to be registered. Your application has to be, your registration form rather has to be received by the clerk, or it has to have a postmark by that date. But if I were you and you have not registered yet, I would go ahead and get it done next week for sure. Just, you know, to be sure that, you know, everything's received in enough time. If you need help with that, feel free to reach out to us at rca@thenewrural.org. That's rca@thenewrural.org, and we will be more than happy to help you with that. And the last rural Arkansas power move that we have is just, you know, and a simple act of you all that you go and you follow and like RCA social media. We're on Facebook. You can find us at Rural Community Alliance. You can also find us on Facebook at Friends of Rural Arkansas Schools and Communities. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/thenewruleAR. You can find us on Instagram at Instagram. Same thing, the New Rule AR. We're on YouTube, Rural Community Alliance. Just go and like and subscribe to our social media, and that way, you know, you'll remain or you'll stay up to date on everything that we have forthcoming around our rural pitch competition that we have, our youth network. So that is a great way to stay up to date on what we're doing at Rural Community Alliance. As always, thank you all for listening and joining in on the podcast today. I hope you learned something and can take something and share it with somebody else. Until next time, take care.